Welcome, readers. This is Elaine Charles, and I'm thrilled we're together for this edition of The Book Report. Now, bibliophiles, I've been traveling in the past weeks and spending a fair amount of time in airport bookstores. In addition to browsing the shelves, I've been having some really fun conversations with fellow travelers about what they're reading. And frankly, yes, I've done some spying, or shall we say observing, as to which titles are being browsed and bought. So, since midwinter break is upon us, and you might be having a few days off, we'll start this week with a focus on what the gals are reading. Then, in an upcoming edition, we'll look at the titles I saw the guys picking up. Now, fellows, stay with us on this one. I promise this won't be a deep dive into chick lit. You may just hear some titles that will help you check in with your emotional side.
Traditional advertising can be expensive and wasteful. But lately, you've been hearing a lot about social media and viral marketing. But let's be honest, it's confusing. That's why you need Magic Buzz, a new marketing company so unique, we've even coined a special phrase for what we do. Socio-viral. We combine the word-of-mouth friendliness of social media, like Facebook, Twitter, together with the viral reach power of YouTube, to create the socio-viral effect. The Magic Buzz team makes sure our clients are well represented online. We recently took word-of-mouth advertising to the number one position as most productive medium for a major cell phone company. That's right. Magic Buzz produced more sales than an expensive TV campaign at a fraction of the cost. Put the power of socio-viral marketing to work for you. Visit us at magicbuzz.com. MagicBuzz.com. If you have any questions, please feel free to email us at info@magicbuzz.com. Magic Buzz. We're there when you can't be.
Steel Magnolias meets The Help in this Southern debut novel, Saving Cece Honeycutt by Beth Hoffman. It sparkles with humor, heart, and feminine wisdom. 12-year-old Cece Honeycutt is in trouble. For years, she has been the caretaker of her psychotic mother, Camille, the tiara-toting, lipstick-smeared laughingstock of an entire town. A woman trapped in her long-ago moment of glory as the 1951 Vidalia Onion Queen. But when Camille is hit by a truck and killed, Cece is left to fend for herself. To the rescue comes her previously unknown great-aunt, Tootie Caldwell. In her vintage Packard convertible, Tootie whisks Cece away to Savannah's perfume world of prosperity and southern eccentricity, a world that seems to be run entirely by women. From the exotic Miss Thelma Rae Goodpepper, who bathes in her backyard bathtub, to Tootie's all-knowing housekeeper, Olita Jones, to Violin Hobbs, who entertains the local constabulary in her canary yellow peignoir, the women of Gaston Street keep Cece entertained and enthralled. Laugh out loud, funny, and deeply touching, Beth Hoffman's sparkling debut is packed full of southern charm, wacky humor, and old-fashioned heart. The book is narrated by Jenna Lamia.
After stuffing the trunk full with bags and boxes, we ran across the street to the Five and Dime, where we sat at the lunch counter and shared a cheeseburger, a bowl of French fries, and a chocolate milkshake. That spring sure was something. I'd never seen Mama so happy. Every day was a big celebration. I'd come home from school and she'd be waiting, all dressed up with a big smile on her face. She'd grab her handbag, hurry me to her car, and off we'd go to do more shopping. Then came the day when Dad arrived home from a 3-week business trip. Mama and I were sitting at the kitchen table, she with a magazine and me with a coloring book and crayons. When my dad opened the closet door to hang up his jacket, he was all but knocked senseless when an avalanche of shoeboxes rained down on him.
"Good!"
he barked, turning to look at Mama.
"How much money have you been spending?"
When Mama didn't answer, I put down my crayon and smiled. "Daddy, we've been shopping for weeks, but everything we got was for free."
"Free? What are you talking about?"
I nodded wisely. "Yep, All Mama had to do was show the salesman a square of plastic, and he let us have whatever we wanted.
What the hell?
Dad pounded across the kitchen floor, yanked Mama's handbag from the hook by the door, and pulled the square of plastic from her wallet.
Damn it, Camille,
he said, cutting it up with a pair of scissors.
How many times do I have to tell you? This has got to stop. No more credit cards. You keep this up and you'll put us in the poorhouse, you hear me?
Mama licked her finger and turned a page of the magazine. He leaned down and looked at her.
Have you been taking your pills?
She ignored him and turned another page.
Camille, I'm talking to you.
The sharpness of his words wiped the shine right out of her eyes. Dad shook his head and pulled a beer from the refrigerator. He huffed and puffed out of the kitchen, kicking shoes out of his way as he headed for the living room. I heard him dump his wide, beefy body into the recliner, muttering the way he always did whenever he was in a bad mood, which, as far as I could tell, was pretty much always. My father didn't smile or laugh very much, and he had a limitless gift for making me feel about as important as a lost penny on the sidewalk. Whenever I'd show him a drawing I'd made, or try to tell him about something I'd learned in school, he'd get fidgety and say,
I'm tired. We'll talk another time.
But another time never came. He was a machine tool salesman and spent much of his time in places like Michigan and Indiana. Usually he'd stay away all week and would come home only on weekends. And most times those weekends were filled with an unbearable tension that sprung loose on Saturday night. Mama would get all dolled up, walk into the living room, and beg him to take her out. Come on, Carl, she'd say, tugging at his arm. Let's go dancing like we used to. We never have fun anymore. His face would turn sour, and he'd say,
No, Camille, I'm not taking you anywhere until you straighten up. Now go take your pills.
She'd cry and say she didn't need any pills. He'd get mad, turn up the volume of the TV, and drink one beer after another. And I'd run upstairs and hide in my bedroom. Whole months would go by, and I'd only hear an occasional kind word pass between them. Even less frequently, I'd see them touch. Before too long, even those things faded away, and my father's presence in the house faded right along with them. Mama seemed glad that Dad stayed away so much. One day I was sitting on the floor of her bedroom cutting out paper dolls while she sat at her vanity and put on makeup. Who needs him anyway? She said, leaning close to the mirror as she smoothed on bright red lipstick. I'll tell you something, Cecilia Rose. Northerners are exactly like their weather. Cold and boring. And I swear, none of them has one iota of etiquette or propriety.
Social media. It's got everyone buzzing these days. But what is it really, and how can you put it to work for you? More than just a passing trend that's hot today, gone tomorrow. Social media is marketing that is making a difference for savvy business people who have jumped into the future. Magic Buzz is a new online marketing company so unique, we've even coined a special phrase for what we do. Socio-viral. We combine the word-of-mouth friendliness of social media like Facebook and Twitter together with the viral reach power of YouTube to create the socio-viral effect. Magic Buzz's socio-viral solution provides the measurable value of online advertising that works, affordable, and effective. So get the buzz going for your business. Magic Buzz, with only one Z, because we're never asleep. Visit us at magicbuz.com. For more information or any questions, please feel free to email us at info@magicbuzz.com. Magic Buzz, we're there when you can't be.
Portia de Rossi weighed only 82 pounds when she collapsed while filming her first feature-length starring role. The film should have been the culmination of all of her years of hard work, first as a child model in Australia, then as a cast member of one of the hottest shows on American TV. On the outside, she was thin and blonde, glamorous and successful. On the inside, she was literally dying. In this unflinchingly honest book, Unbearable Lightness, A Story of Loss and Gain, DeRossi captures the complex emotional truth of what it is like when food, weight, and body image take priority over every other human impulse or action. She recounts the elaborate rituals around eating that came to dominate hours of every day, from keeping her daily intake below 300 calories to eating precisely measured amounts of food out of specific bowls and only with certain utensils. When this wasn't enough, she resorted to purging and compulsive physical exercise, driving her body and spirit to the breaking point. Even as she rose to fame as a cast member of Ally McBeal and Arrested Development, Portia alternately starved herself and binged, all the while terrified that the truth of her sexuality would be exposed in the tabloids. She reveals the heartache and fear that accompany a life lived in a closet, a sense of isolation magnified by her unrelenting desire to become even thinner. From her lowest point, Portia began the painful climb back to a life of health and honesty, falling in love and eventually marrying Ellen DeGeneres, and emerging as an outspoken and articulate advocate for gay rights and women's health issues. In this remarkable work, Portia shines a light on the very dark subject of eating disorders. Unbearable Lightness, narrated by the author, is a story that inspires hope and nourishes the spirit.
I start over. I need to factor in the calories burned. Yesterday, I got out of bed and walked directly to the treadmill and ran at 7.0 for 60 minutes for a total of negative 600 calories. I ate 60 calories of oatmeal with Splenda and butter spray and black coffee with one vanilla-flavored tablet. I didn't eat anything at all at work. And at lunch, I walked on the treadmill in my dressing room for the hour. I'd only walked. The fan I had rigged on the treadmill to blow air directly into my face so my makeup wouldn't be ruined had broken. That's not true, actually. Because I'm so lazy and disorganized, I'd allowed the battery to run down so the plastic blade spun at the speed of a seaside Ferris wheel. I need that fan because my makeup artist is holding me on virtual probation at work. While I'm able to calm down the flyaway hairs that spring up on my head after a rigorous workout, the mascara residue that deposits under my eyes tells the story of my activities during my lunch break. She had asked me to stop working out at lunch. I like Sarah, and I don't want to make her job more difficult, but quitting my lunchtime workout isn't an option. So I bought a fan and some rope and put together a rig that, when powered by fully charged batteries, simulates a head-on gale-force wind and keeps me out of trouble. As I sit up in bed staring into the darkness, my feet making small circles to start my daily calorie burn, I feel depressed and defeated. I know what I ate last night. I know what I did. All of my hard work has been undone, and I'm the one who undid it. I start moving my fingers and thumbs to relieve the anxiety of not beginning my morning workout because I'm stuck here again having to answer the voice in my head. It's time to face last night. It was yogurt night, when I get my yogurt ready for the week. It's a dangerous night because there's always a chance of disaster when I allow myself to handle a lot of food at one time. But I had no indication that I was going to be in danger. I'd eaten my 60-calorie portion of tuna normally, using chopsticks and allowing each bite of canned fish to be only the height and width of the tips of the chopsticks themselves. After dinner, I smoked cigarettes to allow myself the time I needed to digest the tuna properly and feel the sensation of fullness. I went to the kitchen feeling no anxiety as I took out the tools I needed to perform the weekly operation. The kitchen scale, 8 small plastic containers, 1 blue mixing bowl, Splenda, my measuring spoon, and my fork. I took the plain yogurt out of the fridge and, using the kitchen scale, divided it among the plastic containers, adding 1/2 teaspoon of Splenda to each portion. When I was satisfied that each portion weighed exactly 2 ounces, I then strategically hid the containers in the top section of the freezer behind ice-crusted plastic bags of old frozen vegetables so the yogurt wouldn't be the first thing I saw when I opened the freezer door. Nothing abnormal so far. With that, I went back to the sofa and allowed some time to pass. I knew that the 30 minutes it takes for the yogurt to reach the perfect consistency of a Dairy Queen wasn't up, and that checking in on it was an abnormality, but that's exactly what I did. I walked into the kitchen, I opened the freezer, and I looked at it. And I didn't just look at the portion I was supposed to eat. I looked at all of it. I slammed the freezer door shut and went back to the living room. I sat on the dark green vinyl sofa facing the kitchen and smoked 4 cigarettes in a row to try to take away the urge for that icy cold sweetness, because only when I'd stopped wanting it would I allow myself to have it. I didn't take my eyes off the freezer the whole time I sat smoking, just in case my mind had tricked me into thinking I was smoking when I was actually at that freezer binging. Staring at the door was the only way I could be certain that I wasn't opening it. By now, the 30 minutes had definitely passed, and it was time to eat my portion. I knew the best thing for me at that moment would be to abstain altogether, because eating one portion was the equivalent of an alcoholic being challenged to have one drink. But my overriding fear was that the pendulum would swing to the other extreme if I skipped a night. I've learned that overindulging the next day to make up for the 100 calories in the minus column from the day before is a certainty.
Social media. It's got everyone buzzing these days. But what is it really, and how can you put it to work for you? More than just a passing trend that's hot today, gone tomorrow, social media is marketing that is making a difference for savvy business people who have jumped into the future. Magic Buzz is a new online marketing company so unique, we've even coined a special phrase for what we do. Socio-viral. We combine the word-of-mouth friendliness of social media like Facebook and Twitter together with the viral reach power of YouTube to create the socio-viral effect. Magic Buzz's socio-viral solution provides the measurable value of online advertising that works, affordable, and effective. So get the buzz going for your business. Magic Buzz, with only one Z, because we're never asleep. Visit us at magicbuz.com. For more information or any questions, please feel free to email us at info@magicbuzz.com. Magic Buzz, we're there when you can't be.
Dorinda Jones has burst onto the literary scene with her debut novel, First Grave on the Right, which won the 2009 Golden Heart for Best Paranormal Romance. Dorinda can't remember a time when she wasn't putting pen to paper. When she was 5, she'd pick up a pencil and notepad, scribble utter chaos onto the page, and ask her mother to read her masterpiece out loud. Next, she wrote plays for neighborhood kids. In high school, after years of being repeatedly sent to the principal's office for daydreaming, she wrote a post-apocalyptic story about a group of teens who bore a remarkable resemblance to the members of Van Halen. As often happens, life got in the way. She shelved her writing dream in favor of sustenance and shelter, married a local rock star, and had at least 2 kids that she can think of, one of whom is hearing impaired. Dorinda decided to see the cup as half full and went back to college. She graduated from the University of New Mexico with a degree in sign language interpreting. But bit by bit, the desire to write bubbled its way back to the surface. She started writing seriously again in 2002, and now we have book one in the Charlie Davidson series, First Grave on the Right. Welcome, Dorinda. It's great to have you with us today.
Thank you so much.
All right, let's get right into it. How in the world did you come up with the idea for Charlie?
Well, I wanted to write in paranormal, and I love everything paranormal, but there's so much out there. And so I wanted to be different. I wanted to get, you know, editors and agents' attention. So I thought of all the paranormal and supernatural beings out there and decided, well, there's not a lot on the Grim Reaper, so I'll go with the Grim Reaper.
Oh. Oh, I have to ask, is your fondness for paranormal topics related to your residential proximity to Roswell?
Yeah, that could be. I never thought of it, but yeah, we like our aliens.
Okay. Who are your inspirations from the private eye genre and from the paranormal genre?
From the paranormal, I would have to say that there are so many. Of course, I love Stephen King and J.R. Ward and all kinds of writers. And I also love anything by Joss Whedon, who did Buffy the Vampire Slayer. She's my hero. And as far as the private investigator world, I really liked Magnum P.I.
Okay.
That's a big influence.
Okay. Is that because you thought he was hot?
That's a big part of it.
Okay.
No, I like crime dramas. And I like, you know, the whodunits and trying to figure it out. And I love mysteries. And so I just wanted to combine those two worlds.
All right. So this is book one of three. What's next for Charlie? I'm supposing the romance with the son of Satan will continue.
Yes, it continues. It gets... there are a lot of twists, of course, and of course they never have a super duper happily ever after, but their relationship is just going to continue going.
Okay, but readers, I don't know how it could get any hotter than book one, let me tell you.
Yeah, I like to keep up the sexual tension, and part of that is having them, you know, where they almost get together, but then something interrupts them, you know, and so that keeps that tension really tight throughout the series, hopefully the entire series.
I think our listeners would like to know about your publishing experience. What did it take to actually get the first book published?
I've been writing seriously for several years, and I would enter a few contests here and there, and mostly for, you know, which agent is judging or which editor is the final judge. And I joined Romance Writers of America, an amazing organization. I love them. And they have, every year, they have this huge contest. It's like the Academy Awards of romance writing. It's the Golden Heart for unpublished, and the Rita is for published. And I entered every year for like 6 years. I entered the Golden Heart. And I really thought, okay, this year I have a chance. This year I have a chance. And I would never final. I mean, it's huge. There are thousands of entries. And so I entered. Part of the requirement for that is your manuscript must be finished. And so I entered First Grave on the Right really for the sole purpose of forcing myself to finish the manuscript. And I never in a million years thought it would final. And it finaled. I couldn't believe it. You could have blown me over with a soft wind. And so that's what got the ball rolling. It got, you know, just finaling in the Golden Heart gets you a lot of attention. And so I polished it up. I spent 2 months polishing and finishing it up. And I sent it out to agents. And within a week, I had 8 offers of representation after being rejected for years, you know. So that was interesting. And then I won the Golden Heart, and that got a lot of attention. And my agent sent it out. And a week later, we had... several offers, so it sold really fast. It was great.
What advice do you have for listeners who know that they have a great book inside them?
Just sit down and write it. You know, a lot of people, there's so many people want to write a book, and it's not as hard as you think. And one of the things, well, okay, it's not easy, but one of the things that really clicked in my mind was somebody said, if you wrote a page a day, you would have a book at the end of the year. And I thought, oh my gosh, that's so true. And one page a day is nothing, you know? So that really helped solidify how, because it just seemed like such a mountain. Like I just couldn't write an entire manuscript. That seems so hard. But you can. You know, one page a day, a few words a day, and you will eventually have a manuscript.
Well, are you planning another series with a different set of characters after you get through the two other books?
I'm hoping, I just turned in Third Grave, so the first three in this series are done, but this will hopefully be a continuing series, so it'll keep going. Also, I've sold a young adult series to St. Martin's Press, the same publisher. And it also has a Grim Reaper, but in a very different way. So this very different characters, very different situation. And, of course, young adult set in a high school, small town. And so it should be fun. And I see where that will go as well. The first one in that one is called Grim Sight, and it will be out in 2012, April 2012.
Now, when is the second Grave on the... What's the title of the second book in the Charlie series?
It's Second Grave on the Left, and it will be out in August.
Ah, okay. And I don't know, Charlie is not very grim for a Grim Reaper. I mean, how did you come up with that idea for the Grim Reaper when she's such a nice person?
Well, I wanted, you know, I have to be honest. I love Janet Ivanovich's Stephanie Plum series. And I kind of wanted this Stephanie Plum-like character who just attracts trouble like a magnet in a paranormal setting. And so that's kind of part of how I came up with her. And I also took legend and lore and kind of tweaked it a little bit. But a lot of people believe that the Grim Reaper kills their victims and then, you know, they cross or whatever. And actually, in most cultures, the Grim Reaper simply helps the person cross over, you know, or they ferry the boat across the river or whatever. And so that's kind of what I went with, that she just basically helps souls cross to the other side. And, yeah, she didn't kill anybody because we didn't want a serial killer. So.
Well, I have to say, I enjoyed listening to this title. It was a lot of fun. A good mix of suspense and hot. So thank you so much, Dorinda.
Thank you very much.
All right. Bye.
Bye.
She sees dead people. She has one very hot relationship with a son of Satan. She's a private investigator who helps her uncle, a police detective, solve murder cases. And oh yes, she is a Grim Reaper who helps dead people go into the light. First Grave on the Right is Dorinda Jones' debut novel. Take Janet Ivanovich, P.I. Stephanie Plum, throw in some Stephen King light, and this could be the title for you. The book is actually narrated by Lorelei King, who also performs titles by Janet Ivanovich. Let's listen.
I let a lengthy yawn overtake me instead, winced at the soreness shooting through my jaw, then looked back at Dead Guy. He was blurry, not because he was dead, but because it was 4:34 a.m., and I'd recently had my ass kicked.
Hi, he said nervously.
He had a wrinkled suit, round-rimmed glasses, and mussed hair that made him look part young wizard we all know and love, and part mad scientist. He also had two bullet holes on the side of his head, with blood streaking down his right temple and cheek. None of these details were a problem. The problem resided in the fact that he was in my bedroom, in the wee hours of dawn, standing over me like a dead peeping Tom. I eyed him with my infamous death stare, second only to my infamous fluster stare, and got a response immediately.
Sorry, he said, stumbling over his words. Didn't mean to frighten you.
Did I look frightened? Clearly my death stare needed work. Ignoring him, I inched out of bed. I had on a Scorpions hockey jersey I'd snatched off a goalie and a pair of plaid boxers. Same team, different position. Chihuahuas, tequila, and strip poker. A night that is forever etched at the top of my things I'll never do again list. With teeth clenched in agony, I dragged all 470 throbbing pounds toward the kitchen and, more important, the coffee pot. Caffeine would chisel the pounds off, and I'd be back to my normal weight in no time. Because my apartment was roughly the size of a Cheez-It, it didn't take me long to feel my way to the kitchen in the dark. Dead Guy followed me. They always follow me. I could only pray this one would keep his mouth shut long enough for the caffeine to kick in, but alas, no such luck. I'd barely pressed the on button when he started in.
Yeah, he said from the doorway. It's just that I was murdered yesterday, and I was told you were the one to see.
You were told that, huh? Maybe if I hovered over the pod, it would develop an inferiority complex and brew faster just to prove it could.
This kid told me you solve crimes?
He did, huh?
You're Charlie Davidson, right?
That's me.
Are you a cop?
Not especially.
A sheriff's deputy?
Uh-uh.
A meter maid?
Look, I said, turning to him at last. No offense, but you could have died 30 years ago, for all I know. Dead people have no sense of time. Zero, zip, nada.
Yesterday, October 18th, 5:32 p.m., double gunshot wound to the head, resulting in traumatic brain injury and death.
Oh, I said, reining in my skepticism. Well, I'm not a cop. I turned back to the pot, determined to break its iron will with my infamous death stare, second only in...
So then, what are you?
I wondered if your worst nightmare would sound silly. I'm a private investigator. I hunt down adulterers and lost dogs. I do not solve murder cases. I did, actually, but he didn't need to know that. I'd just come off a big case. I was hoping for a few days' respite.
But this kid...
Angel, I said, disappointed that I didn't exorcise that little devil when I had the chance.
He was an angel?
No, his name is Angel.
His name is Angel?
Yes. Why? I asked, becoming disenchanted with the angel game.
I just thought it might have been his occupation.
It's his name, and believe you me, he is anything but. After a geological epoch passed in which single-celled organisms evolved into talk show hosts, Mr. Coffee was still holding out on me. I gave up and decided to pee instead. Dead guy followed me. They always...
You're very bright, he said.
Thanks.
And sparkly.
Uh-huh. This was nothing new. From what I've been told, the departed see me as something of a beacon, a brilliant entity, emphasis on the brilliant, they can see from continents away. The closer they get, the sparklier I become, if sparklier is a word. I've always considered the sparkles a plus of being the only grim reaper this side of Mars, and as such, my job was to lead people into the light, a.k.a. the portal, a.k.a. me. But it didn't always go smoothly, kind of like leading a horse to water and whatnot. By the way, I said, glancing over my shoulder, if you do see an angel, a real one, run, quickly, in the opposite direction.
Anita Shreve is a supremely popular novelist in this genre. I know I've read many of her books, The Weight of Water, The Pilot's Wife, The Last Time They Met, Body Surfing. So before we preview her latest, Rescue, I thought you'd like to know a little about her. Anita grew up in the Boston area. After graduating from Tufts, she taught high school. Later, she left teaching to follow her passion, writing. Anita joked she could wallpaper her bathroom with rejections from magazines. One of her stories, Past the Island Drifting, won an O. Henry Prize. Despite this accolade, she could not make a living writing fiction. She switched to journalism and traveled to Kenya, where she lived and worked for 3 years. One of her novels, The Last Time They Met, contains bits and pieces from her time in Africa. Returning to the States, Shreve worked as an editor for several magazines in New York. And then, in 1999, she received a phone call from Oprah Winfrey. The Pilot's Wife became the 25th selection of Oprah's book club and an international bestseller. In fall 2002, her book, The Weight of Water, came out starring Elizabeth Hurley and Sean Penn. Her newest book, Rescue, begins as a rookie paramedic pulls a young woman from her totaled car, beginning a lifelong tangle of love and wreckage. Sheila is an enigma, streetwise and tough-talking, with fierce desires and a never-look-back determination. Peter, the young paramedic, falls for her instantly. Soon the two are embroiled in an intense love affair, married and parents to a baby daughter. Like the crash that brought them together, it all happened so fast. Shreve explores, can you ever really save another person? 18 years later, Sheila is long gone and Peter is raising their daughter. But Rowan, their daughter, is veering dangerously off track, and for the first time in their existence together, Peter fears for her future. All the love a father can give a daughter is suddenly not enough. Sheila's sudden return may be a godsend, or it may be exactly the wrong moment for a lifetime of questions and anger and longing to surface anew. What tore this young family apart? Is there more damage ahead? Dennis Holland narrates.
Webster doesn't recall buying the eggs, and he's pretty sure the syrup can had only crust at the bottom. I've got the four to midnight, Webster says, covering for Koenig. His daughter's getting married. Rehearsal dinner tonight. Rowan nods. Maybe Webster has already told her. I've got practice till six anyway, she says. What to do about Rowan's supper? He's been asking himself that question for 15 years. He lifts his head and notices a wrapped plate of extra French toast on the stove. Done. Open your present now, Rowan says, the first time either of them has acknowledged the birthday. The father 40 today. Rowan, 5'9 and 17, stands and glides into the dining room. She returns and sets the present to one side of her father's plate. The box is wrapped in gold paper with red Christmas trees. It's almost June. It's all I could find, she says. Webster leans back and takes a sip of coffee. He has the present in his lap. He sees that Rowan has been generous with the tape. With his Swiss Army knife, a present from Sheila 100 years ago, Webster gets the package open and puts the silver cube on the table. He begins to fool with it. He discovers that if he lays it on one side, it tells the time and date. If he sets it on another, it shows the weather for the next 4 days. Two suns, a cloud with rain coming out, and then a sun. It's hooked up to a weather channel somewhere, Rowan explains as she moves her chair closer to her father's. It's better if you keep it near a window. This side is an alarm clock. I tried it. It's not too bad. The sound, I mean. Webster guesses the silver cube cost Rowan at least 3 days' pay from her job at the Giant Mart over the state line. She commutes from Vermont to New York and back again 2 afternoons a week, and every Saturday if there isn't a game. Webster puts his hand on Rowan's back and lightly rubs it just below her long neck. I can really use the outside temperature thing, he says. And what does this side do? Rowan takes the silver cube from her father and demonstrates. You rock it from side to side and then set it down. It tells your future inside the black square. Webster remembers the black balls of his youth, the ones with sayings floating in who knew what liquid, probably something toxic. Whose future? Yours, I guess. It's yours now. Rowan returns the cube, setting it on her father's lap. They wait. Abruptly, Webster flips the cube over, but not before he's seen the ghost of his future struggling to the surface. Prepare for a surprise. He refuses to own the prediction. Why did you do that? Rowan asks. Surprises in my business are nearly always bad. You're too cynical, she says. I'm not cynical, just careful. Too careful for your own good, she adds as she glances at the clock. I have to go. She slips from her chair and kisses his cheek. He watches her graceful movements performed 1,000 times. She holds up her hair, twists it, and lets it fall over her right shoulder. He's never seen this gesture from his daughter, and it hits him in the gut. Thanks for the breakfast and the present, he says. Sure. Webster swivels back to his French toast. He registers an odd silence in the hallway, not the rattle of the knob, the usual friction of the warped door in its frame. After a few seconds, Webster turns his head around. His daughter is still in the back hallway, gazing out the window of the door. What's up? He asks. Nothing. Rowan? Nothing! Don't bite my head off. Webster notices what might be the outline of a hard pack of cigarettes in the pocket of her light jacket. He suspects his daughter is drinking. Is she smoking too? Is she experimenting? Is this normal for a girl her age? Webster can't remember the last time he's felt relaxed with Rowan. For a few moments earlier this morning, his heart lifted, Rowan remembered the birthday Rowan cooked for him. She was excited about his present. Rowan. What? Rowan asks, grabbing her backpack from a hook. I just want you to be happy.
Social media. It's got everyone buzzing these days. But what is it really, and how can you put it to work for you? More than just a passing trend that's hot today, gone tomorrow, social media is marketing that is making a difference for savvy business people who have jumped into the future. Magic Buzz is a new online marketing company so unique, we've even coined a special phrase for what we do. Socio-viral. We combine the word-of-mouth friendliness of social media like Facebook and Twitter together with the viral reach power of YouTube to create the socio-viral effect. Magic Buzz's socio-viral solution provides the measurable value of online advertising that works, affordable, and effective. So get the buzz going for your business. Magic Buzz, with only one Z, because we're never asleep. Visit us at magicbuz.com. For more information or any questions, please feel free to email us at info@magicbuzz.com. Magic Buzz, we're there when you can't be.
Pettigrew's Last Stand is author Helen Simonson's wry, perceptive debut novel about love, the British class system, and family obligations. It genially unfolds amid a quaint, leafy English village, tweedy and provincial as any Miss Marple mystery. Edgecombe St. Mary's home to retired widower Major Ernest Pettigrew, a courtly gentleman whose predictable daily order cracks when he loses his heart to Mrs. Ali, a genteel local Pakistani shopkeeper with crisp enunciation who shares both his devotion to Kipling and the loss of a cherished spouse. As narrated by Peter Altshuler, the book is wistful and rolling, a finely textured comedy of manners, chinks in the family, and it's a book that's getting some rave reviews.
On the mantelpiece, his wife Nancy smiled from her photo, her wavy brown hair tousled and her freckled nose slightly pink with sunburn. They had gone to Dorset in May of that rainy year, probably 1973, and a burst of sunlight had briefly brightened the windy afternoon, long enough for him to capture her, waving like a young girl from the battlements of Corfe Castle. 6 years she'd been gone. Now Bertie was gone too. They had left him all alone, the last family member of his generation. He clasped his hands to still a small tremor. Of course, there was Marjorie, his unpleasant sister-in-law, but like his late parents, he had never fully accepted her. She had loud, ill-formed opinions and a North Country accent that scraped the eardrum like a dull razor. He hoped she would not look for any increase in familiarity now. He would ask her for a recent photo and, of course, Bertie's sporting gun. Their father had made it clear when he divided the pair between his sons that they were to be restored in the event of death in order to be passed along intact within the family. The Major's own gun had lain solitary all these years in the double walnut box, a depression in the velvet lining indicating the absence of its mate. Now they would be restored to their full value, around £100,000, he imagined. Not that he would ever dream of selling. For a moment he saw himself quite clearly at the next shoot, perhaps on one of the riverside farms that were always plagued with rabbits, coming up to the invited group bearing the pair of guns casually broken over his arm. "Good God, Pettigrew, is that a pair of Churchills?" someone would say. Perhaps Lord Dagenham himself, if he was shooting with them that day. And he would casually look as if he had forgotten and reply, "Yes, matched pair. Rather lovely walnut they used when these were made, offering them up for inspection and admiration." A rattling against the door jamb startled him out of this pleasant interlude. It was Mrs. Ali with a heavy tea tray. She had taken off her green wool coat and draped her paisley shawl around the shoulders of a plain navy dress worn over narrow black trousers. The Major realized that he had never seen Mrs. Ali without the large, stiff apron she always wore in the shop. "Let me help you with that," he began to rise from the chair. "Oh, I can manage perfectly well," she said, and brought the tray to the nearby desk, nudging the small stack of leather books aside with one corner. "You must rest. You're probably in shock." It was unexpected, the telephone ringing so absurdly early. Not even 6 o'clock, you know. I believe they were all night at the hospital. It was unexpected. Heart attack, quite massive, apparently. He brushed a hand over his bristled mustache and thought. Funny. Somehow you expect them to save heart attack victims these days. Always seem to on television. Mrs. Ali wobbled the spout of the teapot against a cup rim. It made a loud chonk, and the Major feared a chip. He recollected, too late, that her husband had also died of a heart attack. It was perhaps 18 months or 2 years now. "I'm sorry, that was thoughtless," she interrupted him with a sympathetic wave of dismissal and continued to pour. "He was a good man, your husband," he added. What he remembered most clearly was the large, quiet man's restraint. Things had not been altogether smooth after Mr. Ali took over old Mrs. Bridges' village shop. On at least two occasions, the Major had seen Mr. Ali on a crisp spring morning, calmly scraping spray paint from his new plate glass windows. Several times, Major Pettigrew had been in the store when young boys on a dare would stick their enormous ears in the door and yell, "Pockies, go home!" Mr. Ali would only shake his head and smile while the Major would bluster and stammer apologies. The furor, eventually, died down. The same small boys slunk into the store at 9 o'clock at night when their mothers ran out of milk. The most stubborn of the local working men got tired of driving 4 miles in the rain to buy their national lottery tickets at an English shop.
Didn't love The Devil Wears Prada. I'm betting you saw the movie and maybe even read the book. This time out, author Lauren Weisberger takes a look at the high price of success in our celebrity-obsessed culture in Last Night at Chateau Marmont. The story centers around Brooke, a woman who works as a nutritionist and a consultant at a girls' school to help support her husband Julian's dream of making it in the music world. Things are looking up when, after years of playing divey clubs, Julian finally gets signed by Sony. And then he's asked to perform on The Tonight Show. Julian is catapulted to stardom literally overnight. Amazing opportunities begin popping up. And at first, the newfound fame is fun. Who wouldn't want to stay at the Chateau Marmont or visit the set of one of TV's hottest shows? Yet it seems that Brooke's sweet husband is increasingly absent, even on those rare nights when they're home together. When rumors about Brooke and Julian swirl in the tabloid magazines, she begins to question the truth of her marriage and is forced to finally come to terms with what she thinks she wants and what she actually needs. Let's listen as Merritt Weaver narrates.
They exchanged a triple-cheek kiss. Brooke had protested the full 3 kisses in the beginning, but Luca insisted, before Brooke took a deep breath and walked back to their table. Nola was tucked neatly into the banquette, her suit jacket flung across the back bench, and her navy cashmere shell showing off tightly toned arms and contrasting nicely with her gorgeous olive skin. Her shoulder-length layered cut was stylish and sexy. Her blonde highlights glowed under the restaurant's soft lights, and her makeup looked dewy and fresh. No one would ever know from looking at her that Nola had just clocked in 12 hours on a trading desk, screaming into a headset. Brooke and Nola didn't meet until second semester senior year at Cornell, although Brooke, like the rest of the student body, recognized Nola and was equal parts terrified of and fascinated by her. Compared to her hoodie and UGG-wearing fellow students, The model thin Nola favored high-heeled boots and blazers and never, ever tied her hair in a ponytail. She'd grown up in elite prep schools in New York, London, Hong Kong, and Dubai, places her investment banker father worked, and had enjoyed the requisite freedom that goes along with being the only child of extremely busy parents. How she ended up at Cornell instead of Cambridge or Georgetown or the Sorbonne was anyone's guess, but it didn't take a lot of imagination to see she wasn't particularly impressed by it all. When the rest of them were busy rushing sororities, meeting for lunch at the Ivy Room, and getting drunk at various college town bars, Nola kept to herself. There were glimpses into her life, the well-known affair with the archaeology professor, the frequent appearances of sexy, mysterious men on campus who vanished soon thereafter. But for the most part, Nola attended her classes, aced everything she took, and hightailed it back to Manhattan the moment Friday afternoon rolled around. When the two girls found themselves assigned to workshop each other's short stories in a creative writing elective their senior year, Brooke was so intimidated she could barely speak. Nola, as usual, didn't appear particularly pleased or upset, but when she returned Brooke's first submission a week later, a fictional piece on a character struggling to adapt to her Peace Corps assignment in Congo, it was filled with thoughtful, insightful commentary and suggestions. Then, on the last page, after scrawling out her lengthy and serious feedback, Nola had written, "P.S. Consider sex scene in Congo?" And Brooke had laughed so hard she had to excuse herself from class to calm down. After class, Nola invited Brooke to a little coffee place in the basement of one of the academic buildings, a place none of Brooke's friends ever hung out. And within a couple weeks, Brooke was going to New York with Nola on weekends. Even after all these years, Nola was too fabulous for words. But it helped Brooke, knowing that her friend sobbed during news segments featuring soldiers coming home from war, was secretly obsessed with one day having a perfect white picket fence in the suburbs, despite being openly derisive about it, and had a pathological fear of small, yappy dogs. Walter, Brooke's dog, not included. "Perfect, perfect. No, I think sitting at the bar is just fine," Nola said into the phone, rolling her eyes at Brooke. "No, no need to make a reservation for dinner. Let's just play it by ear." "Okay, sounds good. See you then." She clicked her phone shut and immediately grabbed the red wine, refreshing her own glass before remembering Brooke and filling hers, too. "Do you hate me?" Brooke asked as she arranged her coat on the chair next to her and tossed her wet clutch beside her. She took a long, deep drink of wine and savored the feeling of the alcohol sliding over her tongue. "Why? Just because I've been sitting here alone for 30 minutes? I know, I'm really sorry. Hellish day at work. Two of the full-time nutritionists called in sick today, which, if you ask me, sounds suspicious, and the rest of us had to cover their rotations. Of course, if we met sometime in my neighborhood, maybe I could get there on time." Nola held up her hand. "Point taken. I do appreciate you coming all the way down here. Dinner in Midtown West just isn't appealing."
In this wickedly honest work, Are You There, Vodka? It's me, Chelsea. Comedian Chelsea Handler recalls the most noteworthy highs and lows of her life to date, including her efforts to diversify by dating red-haired men and the dog-sitting interlude in which her boyfriend became overly familiar with a peek-a-poo. Whether it's a vacation with her dad, where he tells airline staff they're a honeymoon couple to get an upgrade, or her elaborate attempts to convince her third-grade classmates that she's starring in a Private Benjamin sequel, Chelsea lets it rip in these entertaining essays. Displaying the candor and irresistible turn of phrase that has earned her stints on The Tonight Show, as well as her own E! Series, Chelsea Lately, this deliciously skewed collection is a guilty pleasure. And it's read by Chelsea.
The idea that showing up at school in a piece of jalopy led to me looking like a dog didn't make much sense in my mind. It really irked me that I had to be punished because my father thought he was a used car dealer and insisted on driving us around in the cars that he couldn't sell. I wanted to tell my classmates that I didn't like his cars either, and I certainly didn't like being called a dog. I hadn't had a low opinion of myself before then, but after being called the same nickname for 6 months straight, you start to look in the mirror and see resemblances between yourself and a German Shepherd. If it had been mild teasing, I think I probably could have handled it, but it was incessant, and it started from the moment I got to school until the moment I left. After a while, most of my friends in the third grade would avoid being seen with me in the hallways because they didn't want to be blacklisted too. My best friend, Jody Sapperman, was the only one who would walk with me to every class and defend me when the fifth grade girls would come over to our table in the cafeteria and ask if I was eating Alpo for lunch. Back to me and Jason. Well, I shouldn't have said lie. I mean, that's the wrong word, I told him. I'm having trouble getting the trailer size I want. I mean, Goldie's being pretty cool, but Kurt is so mercurial. He doesn't understand why a 9-year-old needs a jacuzzi and a personal chef. Oh, I said it all very nonchalantly with a wave of my mitten. These types of things always take time. You get your own trailer? He asked me. Yeah, you know, your own little house when you're on set. Every actor gets one. I mean, there's so much downtime in movies. I mean, you really need a place to unwind. In my opinion, it's not nearly large enough to live in for 3 months, but it's my first major role, so I'm willing to settle for a little less than the creme de la creme. My vast knowledge of movie making at the age of 9 came from spending every free minute watching television, movies, and reading any book about the filming of The Breakfast Club I could get my hands on. I think when you grow up in a house surrounded by cars from the previous 2 decades and parents who insist that $10 for a pair of jeans in 1984 is excessive, you have no choice but to immerse yourself in a world where money is no object. I didn't even know you were an actress, Jason said. How did you get the part? It's actor, I corrected him. The thing is, I was in a little off-Broadway production with Meryl Streep. I took a long pause, allowing him to interrupt. Meryl Streep, he asked. The one from Sophie's Choice? Is there another? I asked, rolling my eyes at his naivete. Anyway, she and I really clicked. I mean, she recommended me to the director of this movie. That's how Hollywood works. One thing leads to another, blah, 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 blah. But they're having a ton of creative issues, so who knows if it will even go. Go where? He asked me. If the movie will even be made. Oh. I could tell Jason was disappointed, and I did not want to lose his attention, so I hurried to keep him interested. I had always dreamed of becoming romantically involved with an older man, and thought Jason not only had the makings of a wonderful lover, but also of a dedicated father to the 2 black twins I had planned on adopting from Ethiopia. I mean, it will go, but it could take months. Maybe you can visit me on set. Really? He asked, his eyes ready to pop out of their sockets. I had to think of something quick to recant my offer after realizing I would never be able to pull it off. So I quickly added, well, I mean, if your parents will let you fly to the Galapagos Highlands. Who? The Galapagos, I said, trying to come up with a reason they would be shooting the sequel to Private Benjamin surrounded by turtles. They have a ton of rare animals there, so the movie's going to be more of her roughing it in the water with jellyfish and seahorses. It's basically a cross between Splash and Private Benjamin. I loved Splash, Jason screamed. That is so cool. Daryl is a complete mess, I told him, shaking my head. Daryl Hannah? Don't even get me started. I snorted for some extra effect. Once we arrived at school, I played it cool and left Jason with his mouth agape. As I told him, I talked to him later and went on my way. It felt great to get attention from him. Even if our star signs didn't end up being sexually compatible, he was cute and popular, and it would definitely not hurt to have him as a friend.
Well, readers, I hope you found some titles you'll pack in your carry-on bag wherever you get to this month, or just have some extra time to relax on President's Day. This is Elaine Charles, and I'm so glad you've made the journey with me today. Thanks to Aaron James, whose music I always carry along on my travels. Remember, you can find out more about today's titles, as well as those from previous shows, on our new website, www.bookreportradio.com. Comments? Suggestions? Drop me a line at elaine@bookreportradio.com. See you in a week for the next chapter of The Book Report.